Welcome to the flyfisher.co.za podcasts. Well, we've got to episode 3. It's been a blast. I've managed to do another 2 podcasts lined up. I'm going to edit them and get them onto the website as quickly as possible. I'm trying to get one out a week, and hopefully you guys are enjoying them. I'm trying to do a technical aspect as well as angles and insights. So some of them are a little bit more technical and some are a lot more relaxed. I got Francois Buerta lined up. That one was done the other day. And I spoke to Mark Yelland. They should be coming up soon. Look out for them. They're both great interviews. Thank you to Man Friday. They came back to me and said that they're thoroughly enjoying it. And it's awesome that I'm using their song. They're a fishing bunch of guys. And I think they realize what we're trying to achieve. This evening's guest is Tom Lewin. He's been fishing since I was a young boy, which makes it many years. He really knows his stuff. But we spoke about a few other aspects to his fishing career. Guiding Lee Wolf and guiding a few other people, his meetings. He also gives interesting insight into the industry at the moment, and he's got some great views on how to improve yourself and the conservation efforts that are going on. I think you guys will enjoy this one. Right, guys, I'm sitting here with Tom Lewin. He's been fishing for more years than most of us, and hopefully we'll get some insights and some interesting happenings. Tom, you're doing all right?
Yes, thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Tom, I'll start off by asking everybody how we got into fly fishing. So what did you do? I know it was many years ago. Can you elaborate on what you started doing?
It's almost so far back I can barely remember. But I was a young boy at boarding school, and I happened upon a book by Charles Waterman in the CNA. And the last of my pocket money, I bought it. And I was absolutely enthralled with the scenes of fly fishing that I saw there. And a little while after that, I scrounged up some money and bought an old fiberglass pole and a reel, and set out there and then to learn to fly fish. So I kind of self-taught from way back in the 70s.
Okay, and then I know that you and another character, Dean, spent a bit of time in the Western Cape. Where did you fish? What did you do? Were you studying at the time?
I'd actually just finished my degree at the time, and my first job was down in Cape Town. Dean was in his last year of studying what, I'm not quite sure, some arbitrary degree at UCT. And we ended up as Dick's mates in Cape Town, and we ended up as housemates because we'd obviously had a common love of fly fishing, or passion for fly fishing, the Western Cape streams. So, yeah, from that moment on, you know, I think fished way too much for my career and for his studies, but those were good times indeed, yeah.
Good. So you spent a lot of time on the Western Cape streams. Is that where you kind of like honed yourself?
Well, certainly where I honed my stream fishing skills, or certainly the basis of my stream fishing skills. We spent many, many hours exploring the cliffs of the Western Cape, and started off fishing the easier waters like the Yellands Putt and the Hull Slurt, and then onto the Smallblaar. And then towards the end, pretty much only fished the Vitter. Sure. Dean and I just made that our personal challenge, and we had some amazing times up there fishing for those big, wily old Vitter Browns, and it was great.
I believe it's not quite the same anymore, but...
Yeah, I believe that is the case, and that is sad. We can only hope that the guys see the sense and get it back to its former glory days, because it really, in those days, I believe, was the prince of South Africa's blue ribbon streams.
True. So you finished studying, you move up to Joburg, or did you go to Natal or somewhere?
Well, I worked in Cape Town for a while, which is where I had the fortune or misfortune, or whichever way you want to say it, of hooking up with Dean. I then worked overseas for a while, and I came back and I was relocated to Joburg, and kind of been here ever since.
Okay, so how do you find time to fish? I know you fished yesterday. Not many of us get much time to fish.
Yeah, time is always a problem, and I don't suppose any of us fish as often as we like. I think that as time becomes more pressured, you start to take the opportunities wherever you can take them, and you become less fussy about spending more time in a motor car relative to the amount of hours fished.
Very true.
You've just got to do what you've got to do.
Very true.
So yeah, I squeeze it in wherever I can, and it's not easy. But I'm fortunate enough to also get to be out in the water with clients when we're guiding. So I guess that's the next best thing. And it all amounts to a fair amount of time on the water.
Yeah, sometimes just being on the water is it. I know you're a little bit of a tackle junkie. What are you currently fishing with apart from a small forest?
Well, on the graphite side, I'm a believer that sage fly rods are absolutely untouchable, both in the salt, right down to the sort of medium-sized 9 foot fives that the guys love to fish on the Vaal and on the Stillwaters. And on the new range of light-lined stream rods, they're beautiful rods. I also have a passionate love affair with fine bamboo fly rods, and I like to fish them, especially on small streams and small ponds where technical conditions prevail. So,
yeah, just to inform everybody, Tom's just worked out a minute little piece of gem artwork that I recently had a look at about 10 minutes before we started this, and what a beautiful rod. That's a 60-year-old fly rod.
Yeah, it's a 60-year-old Granger fly rod, manufactured in Denver in Colorado a long time ago. It's in just about mint, unfished condition. And it's something that I've had my eye on for a long time, and I was lucky enough to give it a good test drive yesterday and christened it on some nice rainbow trout.
Oh,
it was
beautiful.
Awesome.
You've got a lot more of the bamboo stuff, the split cane, and I think we'll keep that for a later episode. Maybe we'll go and touch on that in a future episode. Additional tackle, are you an AquaStealth man or a felt man? What kind of pack and chest pack do you wear?
Quite often if I hair up and down mountains and stuff and I need to carry more than just the bare essentials, I'm talking now about packing in a light raincoat, a fleece, maybe a thermos of coffee and so on. I'm a big fan of the Patagonia pack vest. I've tried a whole bunch of stuff over the years on extended trips to places like New Zealand, where you really do put in the miles upstreams, and suddenly you realize what is comfortable and what a big difference a comfortable, well thought through pack system can make. For my money, the Patagonia pack vest is just right up there, and it's at the leading edge. And what I like about it is that it can convert into a regular vest as well. So for me, it's a good versatile piece of equipment, and it's my favorite at the moment. On the traditional vest side, I'm a big fan of the Sim stuff. I just think that the fact that just about every guide in the four corners of the earth fishes the stuff out of choice says a lot for it. It's superb stuff.
True.
And then on the wading boot side, I favor felt, and I like boots like the Freestone boot, which is a high cut, very sturdy boot for applications like the Vaal River fishing, where you're not likely to cover a huge amount of distance up the bank of the river. I just like it for its sturdiness and its good grip on those sort of rocks. Certainly for running up mountain streams where you're likely to cover a lot of distance and where there's a lot of rock hopping involved, I'm a big fan of AquaStealth. I just think that it grips the rock way better than any other material. And generally, the AquaStealth boots that I'm familiar with are cut in quite a lightweight sort of design, so they don't wear you out when you've run sort of 8Ks round trip up and down a mountain cliff.
True. You talked me into those AquaStealths the other day, and I must say they changed my life on the river. Your favorite methods, I know you spent a little bit of time with Tom down in the Western Cape again, and I know you're more of a purist, but can you touch on what you believe the purism side of the sport might be?
Well, I think that the wonderful thing about fly fishing is it's a completely individualistic pastime, and all that matters in the end is that it's satisfying you, and that you're extracting joy and happiness out of the fishing that you're doing. And there's no one right or wrong way of doing it. Speaking personally, I love to fish dry flies, and I love to fish emerges and basically flies in the film and on the surface. And I just think that the fact that you can actually see the fish come up and eat the fly adds a whole new dimension to the experience. Mm. And I love the way that those flies cast, and I'm a big lover of fly casting. I believe that you can have a wonderful day out fishing, enjoying your casting and enjoying drifting a dry fly, even if the pickings are thin.
Yeah, I must say it's not always about the fish.
It's not always about the fish, and that's certainly not to say that ticking, heavily weighted nymphs along the bottom is not an effective technique. In many instances, if you consider that the majority of the food that yellowfish and trout feed on in the water column are nymphs, that's a dead sure way to produce results. It's going to be the most effective way. But it's not always the prettiest experience, clanking big lumps of lead and ticking them along.
Yeah, I must say, there are times for a Zach and times for a PTN, but but I'm a dry fly man myself. The bit that I really wanted to talk to you about is you've guided some interesting people. I think we'll start off with probably the not the most well-known, but a very well-known celebrity or fly fishing character. Lee Wolf, you spent a bit of time on the Vitter with him.
Yeah, that was way back in the 1980s. While I was living in Cape Town, there was a contingent of, at the time, very famous fly fishermen that came out and did a tour of South Africa, I believe on behalf of South African tourism, with an eye to these guys going back and promoting South Africa as a fly fishing or trout fishing venue. And there were some real heavy hitters. Gary Borger was among the contingent that came out. Daryl Martin was out. And of course, the absolute icon of fly fishing of all time, Lee Wolf.
And you personally got to guide Lee.
I personally got to guide Lee Wolf for a day on the Vitter River. I still have to pinch myself to believe that it's true. But
it's not right.
Yeah, it was a sheer roll of the dice. There were a bunch of us that were asked to come up and help guide these guys. And we made ourselves available, and they basically drew straws out of or names out of a hat. And the name to be drawn for the guy who was going to guide Lee Wolf, all the other guys had a party of sort of two, three, sometimes four Western Cape guides accompanying them. But the bonus prize was the Lee Wolf draw, and that was going to be one bloke to guide him. And yeah, the gods smiled down on me, and
yes,
and so it happened. It was an absolutely amazing experience. He was very old at the time. I think he was in his early 80s, pretty rickety. And we geared up and got onto the river, but after 50 meters or 100 meters, it was plain to see that he was not going to be up to the boulder hopping and that sort of thing. And I'm not quite sure how I suggested it, probably very meekly and humbly, that we maybe sit down and take a break. And so we ended up sitting on a warm flat rock in the afternoon sun on the Vitter River, sharing a sandwich. We bounced a Sprite, and we talked fly fishing. And he told me about his life and how he liked to fish and the great fish that he'd caught. And it was an amazing, amazing experience.
But there is a funny side to the day as well. Why don't you tell us about what happened at the beginning of the day?
Well, I was actually getting a ride up the Bainscliff Pass with a bloke by the name of Tim Ralston, who is probably quite well known to a lot of the listeners out there. He's a well-known Western Cape fly fisherman and guide. Tim and I were doing quite a bit of fishing at the time. And anyway, I was bumming a ride with him. We were hearing up the Bainscliff Pass late on our way to meet these contingent of famous fly fishermen at the top. And suddenly Tim screeched to a halt, and we almost flew through the window, and he smashed into reverse gear and started screaming down the hill again in reverse, screeched to another halt. And at this stage, my eyes were like saucers, and he stuck the handbrake on and jumped out and ran up to a dussy that had been freshly run over on the road, okay? And Tim's always been the kind of guy who's found a patch of material here and stolen a clump of this there and whatever. Anyway, he dumped this dussy into the back of the car, and he said, "That's good fly tying material for later." And we headed our way up the pass. We got to the top of the pass, and all the guys were standing around, and the combi from the hotel on the beachfront where they were staying was parked there, and some guy dressed very smartly from the hotel was handing out lunch packs to these visitors, to Lee and Joan Wolf and Gary Borger and so on. And these nice wrapped lunch packs were being handed out with their names on, and our car, Tim's Golf, was parked right there. And after the last lunch pack had been handed out, Tim opened the boot to get his vest and run out. Saw the dussy there, saw the opportunity in the moment, and grabbed the dussy by the scruff of its neck, all right, and looked at me and said, in that Cornish accent of his, "Well, Tom, are you going to carry the lunch or shall I?" At which point, the overseas fisherman, I think, almost fainted. But that was a good laugh. Yeah, that was a good start to the day.
You said Joan was also with Lee. Did that mean that you guided both Joan and Lee on the same time?
No, Joan was there, and I spent a bit of time initially with the two of them. She's an absolutely remarkable woman, lovely, lovely woman. But she opted to just stay back and chill out at the vehicles and take it easy and have a look for some wildflowers and, you know, just take it easy and leave her husband all 100% to me.
Okay. Good day.
Good day indeed.
And you said Gary was also there, Gary Borger?
Gary Borger was there, also an amazing guy. And I still see Gary every year or every other year when I go over to the Denver show. And the most amazing thing about Gary is that the first time I went over to the States to the retailer show, which was about 6 years ago, I hadn't seen Gary for easily 10, 12, 15 years since he came out on that particular occasion. And I walked up to the stand that he was on, and he looked me dead in the eye, and he said, "Hiya, Tom, how you doing?" And he recounted with absolute detail what happened on that day and stuff that I'd forgotten about. So he's an amazing guy and just brimful of knowledge and an amazingly helpful guy. You know, a guy who's always there to give advice and help you out and give you a theory. Sometimes damn intelligent one at that.
Yeah, I've listened to his son talk, and his dad's a professor and taught him a lot of stuff. So huge respect.
For both of them.
I think Jason's also done some incredible work. Okay, so you've gone from the Western Cape. The next person I want you to talk about, you spent a bit of time in, was you went out to the Seychelles with the guy from Spanish Fly. Let's hear a little bit about what happened out there.
Yeah, that was another real highlight of my fly fishing career or guiding life. Jose Wahebe is the host and star of a fishing program. In fact, the most watched fishing program in the world, called Spanish Fly, which is aired on ESPN. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years ago, it was Dean's idea to get him out and get him to sample the amazing fishing that we've been experiencing with our clients out of Cosmoledo and Stove Atoll in the southwestern Seychelles. So we didn't think that we had a snowball's hope in hell of him ever humouring us. So we mailed the guy, and lo and behold, he came back to us and said he'd be quite keen. And so began a whole series of dialogue between us, which culminated in Jose plus two dedicated cameramen arriving in January this year. And we gave them a week out at a very fancy game farm for them to experience the African bush, and in preparation for some hard, grueling fishing in the flats. And then we shipped them out to Cosmoledo, and he ended up shooting four programs with us for his show to be aired early next year. I guided him one-on-one for 3 days, and Dean guided him one-on-one for 3 days.
Now, there are two humorous stories you're going to tell us about the guiding. The first one is about the Maori biscuits.
All right, here goes my reputation once and for all. A very amusing story. We're standing on the mothership one night, and there were schools of massive GTs schooling around the boat. And they come every night because the lights get put on. Those lights bring the little bait fish, and then the bait fish are just easy pickings for these fish. So you can have 50 or 100 massive GTs cruising on either side of the fish, of the boat. Anyway, one afternoon, we'd had to get off the flats quite early because of a tidal issue, and the guys had obviously spent a bit too much time on the mothership, and 1 hour had turned into two, had turned into three, and of course the boredom had set in. And Captain Jose Wahebe, saltwater fisherman supremo, appeared from the galley, clutching a packet of cream crackers, a jar of peanut butter, and a butter knife. And he didn't say anything. He wandered off, and he got a conventional rod that had a about 40-pound braid on, and a big old bite tippet of 100-pound and a normal hook. And I was watching him, and he didn't say anything. He looked at me, and he took the cream cracker, smeared a big thick smear of peanut butter on, took the 6-0 TMCO hook, stuck it in the peanut butter, smeared another cream cracker with peanut butter, plucked that on the top, okay, and tossed this lot overboard, all right, in amongst these schooling fish. And if you can imagine how, if you've ever seen a coin fall through a swimming pool, how it kind of zigzags down through the water column, so went the peanut butter cracker, okay. Out of the blue, all right, comes this massive, and I mean massive, like 1 meter 60 GT, with a mouth so big that it could swallow a rugby ball without touching sides, inhales the peanut butter cream cracker. Jose Wahebe goes tight on the fish, screams for the cameraman to get rolling, thrusts the rod in my hand, and here I am, attached to a massive GT with a conventional rod and a peanut butter cream cracker on the other end. Yeah. So that was one of the amusing ones that happened. Yeah. Yeah.
I must say I laughed my head the first time I heard that. The other one was, you're guiding them on the flats and they're bonefish everywhere. So you call them to cast.
Two funny things happened that day when we were on the flat. We got onto this flat that was that I know is going to produce really good quantities of nice sized bonefish when the tide starts to push. And we get on the right time, and the two cameramen are holding these big cameras on their shoulders and rolling, and we're walking along, and I turn around and I see the first few bonefish move on through this cut onto the flat, and I move Jose around, and the next minute, the next push of water brings this flood of fish on. And I mean, there must be 100 bonefish, all right, in that sort of 5 to 8 pound class, right in front of us. The water's dark with fish. And I say, and still he stands. And I say, Jose, do you want to cast? And he goes, and this is a guy who sees fish. Believe me, this guy, Mike, this guy sees fish like I've never seen. He goes, where, bro? I don't see him. So I said, I think he's having me on. Okay. Now the cloud's even thicker, the water's even thicker with this cloud of bonefish. And I say, Jose, 12 o'clock, 30 feet. And he goes, I don't see it, bro. And then I realize what's happening. He's looking through these fish, looking for one single fish. His brain cannot register that there can be that many bonefish in any one place. So it's shut out the possibility completely to his mind. And he's actually looking through these fish, looking for a single fish. And then he sees it, okay? And, well, I won't mention what a series of expletives were, but... And then, of course, fell around the place, clutching his sides. He's that kind of a guy. Brilliant sense of humor. Absolutely superb human being. And one of the all-time highlights of my life, to just to guide and to have to do with a human being like that. But something else that happened, which is quite amusing on that flat as well, was that we have a rigid, staunch policy in our business that guides never fish. Guides are there to make sure that the clients experience the maximum experience, and guides never fish. It's something that's frowned very, very heavily upon. Anyway, I've been fishing along with Jose in various conditions over the 3 days, and we wind up on this flat. It was going to be the last fishing experience of my 3 days with him. And he caught these bonefish until he couldn't anymore on this flat. And then he said to me, "Go on, you have a throw." And I said, "No, we've been through this before, Jose, you know." And he said, "You are going to throw at these fish, because part of the way that I do my program is we like the guide to have a little fish at the end. It's just the way we do it." And I said, "No, look, I'm not buying this. It's not going to happen." And he kind of winked at the cameraman and smiled and didn't say anything. And we fished on. And 15 or 20 minutes later, I'd completely forgotten about the incident. I'm holding the 12-weight rod, which is rigged up with a big 6-0 fly in case we have a lunatic GT that decides to stray across our path on the flat. And he's obviously fishing with his 9-weight for the bonefish. And I see him signal to the cameraman and say something sort of behind my back. And as I turn around, he says, "Tom, can I have a look at something on that 12-weight quickly?" And he puts his hand out and grabs the 12-weight from me, and at the same time he puts the 9-weight rod in my hand. And I take the 9-weight rod, and he goes, "Yeah, I got you. Now you are going to fish with that." Oh, man. So anyway, I will say that I had one cast, and thank God I stuck the fly on the button and got the fish to eat, and because the pressure was... more than a lot.
More than a lot. I think we've covered that nicely. Thank you. Those insights are excellent. I really appreciate it. We know that you're part of Frontier. How did Frontier start?
Well, Frontier started through a kind of idle conversation that my now partner Dean Rapagan and I had sitting on the banks of a river in the south island of New Zealand called the Areti. And I was in between careers at the time. I'd spent kind of the last 10 years in the ad industry. Dean was also kind of in between stuff, and we'd taken time out and gone back to New Zealand for a 6-week period to fish. And we'd been bummed out by the weather one afternoon. We were sitting, I think as I recall, sipping on some disgusting 2-minute noodle type drink to warm ourselves up on the banks of this river. And we got chatting about the fly fishing industry back home. And the long and the short of it, Mike, is that we figured at the time that you know there's an old saying that the game rangers say that you don't need to outrun the lion, you just need to outrun your friend. And which basically means that we didn't have to reinvent the wheel, but if we saw a scope to do the job better, there was an opportunity in it. And the more we chatted about it, the more it seemed on the cards, and started out as kind of, as I said, just a wild flirtation with a dream that two guys have after a day's fishing on the banks of a river, actually started to take shape and materialize. And so I put a business plan together with Dean, and we took quite a few months to do that after I got back. I'd in fact written entrance exams and was about to start an MBA with WITS, which I canned, and poured all my energy into putting the business plan for this thing together, and it looked viable, you know. And it's never a dead cert, and it always takes a leap of faith and takes some courage and some self-belief, but we did it. And and we immediately flew out to the States and secured what we thought were the best agencies to have, and set about servicing the market in the way that we thought the market deserved to be serviced and provided for. And that was almost 6 years ago, and it's hard to believe that time's flown the way that it has, and that the business, thank God, has prospered and I think really done very well, and I think served the South African fly fishermen very well.
Yeah, I'm not going to run into all the brands that you carry, but what is the future? I know you guys are doing a lot of travel at the moment. Is that where you guys are going to move to?
It's hard to say, where it'll go. I look back with amusement the other day at our original business plan, and it's just funny to see how different things have worked out. But I suppose, in order for those things to work out, no matter how differently, there needs to be a plan. Right now, we're just going through a period of kind of consolidating and trying to get what we do right, which is the retail shop. And the big part of that and the exciting part of that for us is our online shop, which we're working very hard at promoting and establishing and growing. And then, of course, the travel side. And, which is for us more than just travel and more than just a fishing trip. What we try to do is visit venues and give people experiences. We're selling a whole experience. We're not just selling a fish on the end of the line. So we've got some pretty cool destinations, from peacock bass in the Amazon to the biggest rainbow trout on God's planet in Argentina, to amazing saltwater venues, to some pretty awesome local venues.
True. Which kind of leads me into my next question, because I know you went to the fly fishing show last year and you managed to get some fishing in before and after. Where have you fished around the world? You mentioned New Zealand. I know you've been to Cosma and South America, but you're well-traveled.
Yeah, I fish quite a lot in New Zealand. If I had to add up all the number of days, it's probably 3 or 4 months worth of fishing in the South Island of New Zealand, all told. Of course, I fished each and every inch of this country. I've fished a lot of Mozambique and the Seychelles on the salt side. I fished around the UK and Scotland and Ireland. And I've done quite a bit of fishing in the American West as well, around Montana and Idaho. Mm-hmm. And in the Rocky Mountains around Colorado.
Okay, where would you rate as the top one of those kind of destinations? If it was my first trip, where would you send me off to?
Well, I just think that uh, that that Montana and that side of the American West just absolutely defines what you know, what fly fishing is all about. You've got everything there from, you know, from little meadow streams to big brawling freestone rivers like the Madison to the highly technical spring creeks around Livingston. It's just got everything, and there's a whole culture of fly fishing that pervades in those areas.
True. I'm trying to ask everybody these kind of questions. We have a yellowfish population in this country which needs a bit of work behind it. What are your thoughts on conserving our yellowfish?
Well, I think it would be the greatest tragedy and something that we would stand to be blamed for by our children and their children and their children to come.
True.
If we ever allow anything to happen, you know, to our yellowfish populations in this country. So I think that you're absolutely right. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. There's a lot of good work being done at the moment, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And I think that principally, the way that things should happen is that people should focus on the bigger issues first, and then whittle down and get down to those niceties, those smaller issues that don't really impact as heavily as those big important issues do right now.
When you say big issues, what are you talking about?
You know, It's fairly common knowledge that that certain state departments are not playing their bit when it comes to maintaining sewage works, and that there's, you know, tons and tons, probably thousands of tons of raw sewage that finds its way into majorly important river systems like the Vaal and the Orange River system. You know, that squatter settlements on rivers like the Clip pose very, very serious problems.
True.
And that the controls on the industrial waste dumping need to be clamped down. And I think that those are the issues that the Conservancy guys should really be focusing on right now. I'm a little shaken, to be honest, and a little more than a little concerned at kind of right-wing sort of Nazi attitudes that have been taken, for example, towards fish like trout. And I can understand that keeping trout out of sensitive rivers where indigenous fish are housed and live is a very important thing. But I think that, you know, declaring a kind of blanket ban and of a fish like that is not at all useful. And I think that the kind of energies could way better be focused on bigger issues right now, like, for example, the waste spillage and the sewage spillage and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think the thought process on conservation is quite right. Kill the big issues, and then the smaller issues generally take care of themselves. Advice for beginners?
Advice for beginners, make sure that the gear that you're going to start out with and the gear that you're going to use to gauge whether you like fly fishing or not is the appropriate stuff. You know, too often we have people coming through our shop who've been given the wrong sort of advice and who end up with completely inappropriate gear, and from then on it's just an absolute uphill struggle to learn to cast and to learn to fish. So my advice for beginners, first off, would be, you know, go and see a reputable specialist fly fishing business, talk to guys who are well experienced, who can give you the right kind of advice, and more importantly, who can be there for you, you know, through the journey, and who can continue to help you and give you those casting lessons and those little bits of advice that are going to help you along the road and fast track your success as a fly fisherman.
I agree. Okay, running out of time, so we'll run into our quick fire favourites. Favourite dry fly?
Would have to be a Royal Wolf.
Favourite nymph?
Gold ribbed Hersia nymph.
Favourite rod?
Favourite rod is a 7.5 foot, 4-weight Chris McDowell, based on a Payne 198 taper. It's a cane rod.
Favourite venue?
It would have to be the spring creeks around Livingston and Montana. It would be Nelson Spring Creek, DePaia Spring Creek, and Armstrong Spring Creek.
Favorite species?
Trout.
Favorite technique?
Upstream or up and across, or across and down with a dry fly or merger.
Favorite gizmo or gadget?
I would have to say the Sims Pigtail Retractor. I bought one and I don't think I've replaced it in 20 odd years, and I think prior to that I must have gone through 100 of those horrible little wheels with the springs that wear out and break on you in the middle of a day's fishing.
Favourite movie?
In terms of real contemporary stuff, the Trout Bum Diaries, particularly the Patagonian volume, absolutely awesome, just brilliant.
Favourite author?
John Gira.
Favourite book?
Trout Bum.
Interesting sightings on a river?
I say the most interesting sighting on a river kind of typifies the the ever-growing tension and aggression due to overcrowding on rivers. I was fishing with Dean on a very famous river in the American West called the Missouri. And we were standing on a bend of a river with a beautiful glide and nice gravel shelving into deep water. And we'd spotted a few fish that were stacked up. And we were approaching them from below, nymphing for them. And around the corner came a guide in a drift boat, two sports on their seats on either side, oars crashing around. And if we hadn't removed our lines from the water, I reckon they would have been tangled up in those oars. He came crashing through the glide, didn't bother to apologize, and off they went cruising down the river.
Sure.
And it wasn't long after that, in fact, that I read of situations there where wade fishermen were actually throwing rocks at drift boat fishermen. So that's the ugly side of fly fishing, and I must say my jaw was on the ground. I'd seen poor etiquette in my time, but this one took the bakery. Yeah.
Sure. And here's probably the toughest question of the whole day, because you are so well traveled and been around to all the places that I want to fish. All expenses paid trip anywhere in the world.
I would have to say that it would be Argentina for me, because it just has a little bit of everything. It has some amazing small stream fishing for trout in Sydney, some of the most incredibly beautiful streams in the world. You have the big old sea run browns that run up down near the coast. You have lake chock-a-block with massive rainbows. You have surely the biggest brook trout on the planet.
Sure.
So it just... For sheer variety and quality of fish and astoundingly beautiful countryside and amazing people and fabulous steaks and wines, and it's cheap. So, it's an amazing country, and I can't get enough of it.
Right, thank you very much, Tommy. We appreciate all your comments and experiences. I hope to interview you soon about your bamboo collection, and hopefully by then it's grown to more than just your bamboo collection and I should have my first stick. So thank you again for your time.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks a lot, Mike.
They say you know life is given, but I tell you now, it's all within that river. You find yourself in the heart of heaven. Clothes off so long, you could swim forever. One place to rest your grace, a silver sands lead the way. The water's golden stories told, free clouds, sapphire summer days. Fun way to spend today, take yourself deep right away. Drive 6 hours, walk 5 days. Hey, hey, hey.